So tonight's talk is called The Four Noble Truths and the Art of Letting Go. So I'll start by sharing that when I was a kid, my dad would teach me different survival techniques, like how to build a shelter or how to distill water or to catch fish or birds for food. So it stood out to me when I heard a unique story or a unique strategy Indian farmers would use to catch monkeys. So they'd start by finding a coconut, then they'd carve a hole in the coconut, and after that, they'd slide a banana inside. And when they were finished, they'd tie it to a tree. And then some unsuspecting monkey comes along, smells the banana, reaches into the coconut to grab and grabs hold of the fruit inside. And so it's easy for the monkey to get its hand in, but it can't pull it out once it's holding the banana. The only way out of the coconut trap is to release the banana. But the thing is, the monkey doesn't want to do that. The monkey wants the banana, so it keeps holding on. If it would just let go, the monkey could escape, but it won't let go. So eventually, the hunter comes and the rest is history. So, if you're anything like me, hearing this monkey catching technique sounds all too familiar. Much like this monkey, we too grasp the things that we want, we cling to them. But once we realize that we're stuck or we're suffering over what we want, we find that it's nearly impossible to let it go. We find that we're, in a way, we're held captive by our desires and our aversions, and our inability to let go is really causing us to suffer. So letting go, of course, sounds very simple, and yet the capacity to let go often seems to be out of our control, and it proves to be much more challenging than we'd like. And more often than not, letting go, when it does happen, it takes a lot longer than we want it to. The Thai forest master Ajahn Chah said, 70 to 80% of spiritual life is knowing you're clinging and not being able to let go. Letting go is not easy. And while many of us grow up hearing the advice to, oh, just let it go, few of us have actually learned how to do that. Like, how do we actually let go? And then also, how does this seemingly universal teaching relate to the practice of Buddhism? So that's what we're talking about tonight. I'll be teaching on the Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths, which happens to be one of the most central Buddhist teachings, if not the most central, and then how that supports us in letting go. So what are the Four Noble Truths? There is suffering. The second, the source of suffering, that is craving. The third, there's an end to suffering. It's freedom or enlightenment, awakening. And the fourth, the path, the Eightfold Path, which is actually, the practice for awakening. So there's a reason the Buddha was known as the great physician or the great healer. And it's because he saw that all beings were afflicted by a disease, which happens to be called suffering, and he provided a diagnosis, a treatment, and a cure. And this is the Four Noble Truths. We could actually frame the Four Noble Truths as a medical intervention of sorts. Like, we recognize that we're sick, we learn the diagnosis, the cause of the sickness, we realize that a cure is possible, and then we engage in the medical treatment. And part of what's so profound about the Four Noble Truths is that it identifies one diagnosis, one treatment, one cure for all types of suffering. It actually describes the common root of all our difficulty and how to be free of it. So it's a pretty powerful remedy. And we can remember that that common root at the heart of all our suffering is craving. So tonight, specifically, I'll be focusing on the second and third noble truth and the movement between them, the movement from craving and clinging to freedom. So put very simply, what we could say that movement from craving to freedom, from craving to happiness, is letting go. So that's where our letting go practice comes in. Just like the monkey with its hand stuck in the coconut, we hold on and we hold on and we hold on. And as long as we do so, we're trapped, we're suffering. But when we let go, just like the monkey, we're free. Now, before I get much farther with that, let's spend a little time just going through the first and second noble truth, and then I'll spend some time with the third as well. So, first noble truth, in brief, there's suffering. The Pali word for suffering is dukkha, as many of you know. And sometimes dukkha is translated in other ways: unsatisfactoriness, difficulty, stress, uneasiness. And it's happening in small and large ways all day long. So my socks are too itchy, or that one conversation left me feeling insecure. The food's too salty. My elbow hurts. My coworker is incompetent. I'm incompetent. If I only looked as good as she does, or they do, or if I had the right outfit, or relationship, or car, or job, or apartment, then I'd be happy. So this sense of unsatisfactoriness, that things are never quite perfect or quite adequate or what they should be, that's the place it's coming from. So this is suffering in a nutshell. So, second noble truth, the cause of suffering. So, like I said, there are myriad ways to suffer, but it all distills down to one thing, tanha. That's the Pali word, which actually means thirst. And it's speaking of this sort of unquenchable thirst. And that we might translate that as craving, as desire, wanting, attachment, grasping, greed. And that's that impulse is directed to possessions, to sense pleasures, things that taste and smell and feel and look pleasing. It's directed to people, to experiences, ideas, concepts, power, you name it, achievements, to our body being a certain way, to who we are, to being a certain way in the world. Anything and everything can be an object of craving. Now, I want to note that tanha, the craving in the Four Noble Truths, doesn't include all expressions of desire. Now, the Buddha actually talked about certain wholesome expressions of desire, like the desire for liberation or to be kind or to be generous. These are wholesome desires. So the Four Noble Truths aren't saying that those are the source of suffering. So just to be clear there. And also, when I say, when I talk about craving, that craving also includes aversion. It's just two sides of the same coin. Aversion fixates on an object in the same way desire does. The mind grabs hold of it. And craving wants it, aversion doesn't want it. When we want something, there's also something we don't want. So in that way, when you hear me say craving, you could always sub that word out for aversion if that is feels more relevant to you. So typically in life, it seems like we suffer because of circumstances or external causes, maybe a mean boss or an injury or something like that. However, of course, the actual suffering occurs in how we're relating to that circumstance. If we react to circumstances with craving or aversion, suffering will be present. Because the way that desire operates, it's as if it's saying, this situation or this moment isn't good enough as it is, or I'm not good enough as I am. So it's an expression of the mind's inability to be content with things as they are. So once we see the source of dukkha is in the mind, that's where there's an opportunity for transformation. You can't control the world, but we can transform our mind. Ajahn Suchito, the Thai forest monk and teacher, he said, first, we think we need to get out of this predicament. Then we realize we are the predicament. So it's the desire itself in our mind that's causing the suffering, us alone. And part of the problem with desire, with craving, is that it's insatiable. So that unquenchable thirst, Its promise of happiness is a ruse, because it'll always want just one more. There's an old Zen story about two traveling monks who came to a river, and at the riverbank there was a woman that was waiting there, and she appeared to be scared of the current, but she wanted to cross, so she asked one of the monks if he would carry her. One of the monks immediately declined, but the other quickly picked her up, put her onto his shoulder, and transported her across the water, and then put her down on the other bank. She thanked him, and she departed. As the two monks continued on their journey, the monk that declined started to become very preoccupied with his thoughts. And after quite a while of ruminating, he couldn't hold it in any longer, and he finally blurted out, "Brother, our spiritual training teaches us to avoid all contact with women. What were you thinking? You picked that woman up and carried her across the river. Like that's breaking such an important rule." And in response, the other monk calmly said, "Well, that happened many, many miles back. Yes, I carried the young woman, but I set her down over an hour ago. So why, brother, are you still carrying her?" So often in our lives, we're carrying the memory of something that has long since passed, maybe a time we were hurt by someone, a resentment, or sometimes carrying a memory of a beautiful time that we're pining to recreate, or a beautiful person we wish would return. And we keep carrying that memory and that longing. We're clinging to it in a sense, and we can't seem to put it down. We can't seem to set it down on the other shore, even though the actual event or experience passed away a long time ago. So what then? How do we let go when we're holding on? So this is the movement from the second noble truth of craving and clinging to the third noble truth of freedom. So the third noble truth, the Buddha said, "Both formerly and now, what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering." The first noble truth and the third noble truth. So enlightenment, freedom is possible. It's actually possible to be free from suffering. It's possible to uproot craving, aversion, and delusion completely. And this is what the entire Buddhist path is all about. It's about freedom from suffering. It's about happiness. And there's a reason that the Buddha was known as the happy one. And we hear this refrain in the suttas again and again. He says, the Buddha says, "This is peaceful. This is sublime. That is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana." Nibbana, nirvana, liberation, dependent on the destruction of craving, relinquishing of all attachment. So this is speaking to a complete liberation, a complete uprooting of the defilements. But we don't need to be on the brink of full enlightenment to have a taste of freedom. So every time we move from clinging to non-clinging, we manifest what Ajahn Buddhadasa would call temporary nibbana, temporary enlightenment. It's a temporary freedom from the defilements. And we can lean into this temporary nibbana every time we let go of our clinging. And if we don't let go, we suffer. As they say, let go or be dragged. And sometimes simply remembering that letting go is possible is enough. And this is the first approach. Let it go. Sometimes we realize that we don't have to continue obsessing or ruminating about something. And just the simple invitation to let it go works. And if that's available to you, then great. Go for it. But more often than not, we might let something go, but then it comes back and it comes back and it comes back. And most of us want to let go of what troubles us once and for all. To finally stop grieving the ex-partner or the passing of a loved one, or to finally let go of the incessant holiday planning or whatever it is. But often we can't let go once and for all. So what then? So now I'd like to get into some specific letting go practices. So the first letting go practice I'll offer is what I'll call momentary letting go. And you do this all the time in your meditation. The thought of, say, resentment arises. You recognize you're caught in that thought. Then you let go of the thought and come back to the body or the breath. So that's letting go. The resentment thought might appear a few minutes later, but then you just practice letting go again. And every time you do that, you're strengthening that muscle of letting go. You're strengthening that capacity. And in that movement, that strengthening, you're training for the big letting go, which is liberation itself. So that's momentary letting go. The next practice I'll offer, which I pointed to in the meditation, is what I'll call recognize and feel. So let's say you're really stuck on holiday planning and you've let go of it over and over and over. But clearly something is going on here if it's recurring with this much frequency. So you might ask yourself, is craving or aversion present? Because that question illuminates the second noble truth. And craving and aversion so often disguise themselves. They're so hard to see because we're so fixated on circumstance. So at first, for example, at first we think the problem that is that our partner isn't taking out the trash. But instead, can we recognize that, oh, there's some distress here, that okay, there's a I feel like this is a problem. So there's some suffering. And the source of that suffering isn't the partner not taking out the trash. The suffering is the aversion that's present. Like, gosh, I keep thinking about my partner in the trash. Huh, is craving or aversion present here? Oh yeah, there's some aversion here. Okay. So if we can do this, then something wonderful is happening. Recognition has taken place. If this is all you can do is be able to see the aversion below a thought pattern, to be able to identify the craving in the mind heart while you're obsessing about something, that is a fantastic thing. So you've shifted. If you do that, you're shifting from you're shifting from fixating on the object of aversion to the aversion itself. So it's really simple. It's really simple, but it's hard to see because our object fixation is so strong. So that's recognize. Then the second piece is feel. So what's it feel like to want something or not want something? Really get to know what it's like when you get hijacked by these forces of desire and aversion. So checking it out in the body specifically. Is there pressure, temperature, tightness, heat, tingling? Often with wanting and not wanting, there's some form of contraction in the body. And what we find is often the sensations associated with wanting and not wanting are painful to a certain degree, even if it's subtle. It's actually painful to want a future moment, or painful to resist things as they are. Craving and aversion are dukkha. And it's really important to recognize this. And it's really important to feel this, these two steps. And here's why I recommend this practice of recognize and feel. Because as we do this, over time, our inner wisdom begins to understand, when I experience craving, I suffer. And that connection is really important. Over time, by being fully present with craving or aversion, the mind heart learns where the actual source of dukkha lies. When the heart mind learns where the suffering actually is, but it's in the craving and not in the object, then wisdom is born. And this wisdom is what does the letting go. So you don't need to let go. The wisdom lets go for you. So that's what's so profound about this practice of just simply recognizing what's happening and feeling it. You don't need to figure out how to fix your problems or how to let go of your problems. You just need to practice letting be. Oh, I'm just going to let it be. I'm going to recognize what's happening and I'm going to feel it. And then the wisdom eventually lets go for you. Because what's happening is you're seeing, you're associating the craving or the aversion with the dukkha. You're recognizing that's what's present and seeing, oh, this is where the pain is. It's not in the myriad external circumstances. And if you recognize and feel that over and over and over again, the mind heart goes, ouch, this hurts. It's like putting a hand on a hot stove over and over and over again. Eventually, the body goes, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not going to touch that again. The mind heart doesn't want to pick up the craving and aversion. So this is how the letting go happens. So an example of this. In my early 20s, I developed a disability that impacted my ability to digest food. And there was a time when I was really quite ill and I could barely eat and I was very thin and I was experiencing some version of starvation and it was quite difficult. But I was very sincere about my Buddhist practice. And so I would pay attention if there was suffering. And one area where I particularly suffered was, as you would guess, during mealtimes. And I could only eat a few bites for a meal. So let's say I was eating a hard-boiled egg for lunch. I might start eating the egg, get halfway through, and not be able to finish. And at the end of my meal, I'd notice my eyes would make contact with the egg remaining on the plate, and I'd suffer. And for a long time, I'd fixate on my inability to eat as the source of my suffering. And I'd be really upset that I only had half an egg for lunch. But over time, I began to see things differently. So realizing this was a pattern, when I looked at the food I couldn't finish, if I was suffering, I might ask, is craving or aversion present? And I would one, recognize that craving was present, and then two, feel the intensity of that craving in the body. And it was a painful craving. I really wanted to eat. Like it was a fierce craving. So it was very palpable that there was a lot of dukkha there, that craving was suffering. And there was no way I could let go of that craving. I was completely hooked. All I could do was let it be. I couldn't let go. But over time, I noticed that the mind heart had released. It had let go of the craving, such that that moment at the end of meals was no longer a time when I suffered. And I really noticed the mind shift its relationship to food. So, for example, I was sitting in my room at San Francisco Zen Center some time ago, and I had eaten. It was one of these situations where I had a microscopic amount of food for a meal, and I couldn't eat anymore. But I remembered that there was some sort of treat in the house. I think it was like a slice of cake or something like that. And there was enough mindfulness present to see the food thought arise in the mind, like a little cake image floated in the mind. And then there was the slightest lean towards that cake, like kind of to take hold of it, like, ooh, that's what I want to eat right now. And of course, that's the moment where clinging would typically occur and the wanting would rev up. And then, oh no, I can't have that and suffering. But with no volition of my own, that craving just stopped in its tracks and it completely dropped away. It was like leaning towards the cake image and it just kind of rested back and dropped. And the little cake image floated right on past, and no suffering arose. So, in that moment, I didn't let go of the craving. And I didn't let go of the cake. Wisdom saw that craving was about to cause suffering. And just like reaching for a hot stove, wisdom let go of the craving. It said, I'm not touching that stove. Wisdom let go of the cake. So the wisdom in the heart mind knew that the suffering wasn't in my inability to eat what I wanted. The suffering was in the clinging. So it let go on its own. The mind knew it was painful to pick up that type of suffering. And this is now the norm for my mind. It doesn't pick up food craving in the same way it used to. And this is the way that letting things be leads to letting things go. And this is the movement from the second noble truth to the third noble truth. So all you need to do is recognize and feel. And over time, the citta learns to release the dukkha. So this is letting go practice. And this letting go practice is really a letting be practice, right? Letting be is so important. If a snake isn't ready to shed its skin, you can't force it to let its skin go, right? It doesn't matter how annoyed you get at the snake for not letting its skin go, or how much contempt you feel for it for not letting its skin go, or how much you hate it for not letting its skin go. The only way to force a snake to let go of its skin before it's ready to shed is to skin the snake. To push ourselves to let go of something before we're ready to let it go, it's just like skinning the snake. And skinning a snake is violent, and we never want to be violent with ourselves. When we encounter a difficulty that we're really hung up on, and we see we're attached, if we're not naturally able to let it go, we can drop in that possibility, invite it. But if it doesn't naturally fall away, don't go to war with it. Don't skin the snake before it's ready to shed. When we're being tormented by a difficult situation and we're suffering over a circumstance, and we can't seem to get over it, most people want to exclaim something like, "Come on, can't I let this go? Let go already." And this sort of impatient or annoyed attempt to let go, of course, is just aversion. So I just want to highlight that because often when we're trying to let go with that sort of energy, the sort of like, come on, let go already energy, chances are what's really happening is that we're suffering and we have aversion towards the suffering. So we want to get rid of it. So just flag that if you notice that sort of effort to let go. Notice that aversion is present and recognize and feel. So, if we're suffering because we have aversion, to then reject our suffering is just aversion towards aversion. And that's kind of a mess, right? But we do it all the time. We multiply our suffering by going to war with it. So, don't go to war with your suffering. So, watch for this. Notice if you're intolerant of your suffering. So that's just aversion sneaking in through the back door. Ultimately, when we can't naturally let go of something, the wisest thing we can do is let go of letting go. Let go of letting go. Just let it be. I think the Beatles figured that one out a long time ago. There was a nun who was dying of cancer at Amaravati Monastery, and she was in a lot of distress. And she was crying out to one of the senior monks, and she was saying, "I can't let go. I can't let go." And the senior monk said, he leaned in and he said, "Then let it come. Let it come. This is letting it be." When we practice letting it be, we're practicing acceptance. Or another word that might resonate is we're allowing. And that's what this is all about. We're allowing things. We're accepting that the snake is going to shed on its own time. So if it's helpful, you can practice recognizing and feeling, and don't forget to allow or accept. So the last practice I'll offer you is notice the moments of non-clinging, when the heart actually does let go, when you finally release what ails you. Make sure to notice it. Be really present for what it feels like to be free from bondage, to be free from craving and clinging. So recognize and feel that too. Okay, so in closing, I'll share something from the scholar monk Bhikkhu Anālio. He said, I think Phineas the orange cat is chiming in. I'm not sure if you can hear him meowing in the background. So Anālio, not Phineas, said something like, in the fall, a tree lets go of a leaf, no matter how beautiful the leaf. We can tell the difference between a living tree and a dead tree because dead trees hold on to their leaves. In the fall, a tree lets go of a leaf, no matter how beautiful the leaf. So this struck me because, in a way, we don't always feel fully alive when we're clinging, when we're holding on to our leaves. So sometimes it feels like we're being crushed by the weight of our attachments, or like we're being strangled by clinging or poisoned by our aversion. Sometimes, to live most fully, we need to release even the most beautiful leaves. And sometimes it feels like our life depends on it. So, lastly, this by Mary Oliver. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. Let's sit for a moment. Thank you for your kind attention. So, of course, when we see somebody else suffer, that can cause us to suffer, especially as a parent. It's a very natural way to suffer. And as part of our sitting practice, particularly when we're able to be still and really rest and notice what's happening, we can give that suffering attention. And one way we can do that is by being really kind and compassionate with it. There, sweetheart. This is hard. This is hard. You're not alone. You're just bringing some kindness and gentleness to the suffering. And part of what happens over time, sometimes it doesn't feel so available. Sometimes that sort of self-nurturing doesn't feel as accessible. But even just that ever so slight gentleness towards the suffering helps the suffering feel safe. It lets it know that it's allowed, it's accepted, it can be felt, it can have your full attention. And often that allows it to metabolize. And part of that also, that when you feel it, that, and you notice, oh, I'm suffering, you can practice recognize and feel. In that moment, like, oh wow, I'm really suffering over my child. Wow, oh, what's happening here? Wanting or not wanting present? Oh, not wanting. Ah, oh, there's a lot of not wanting this situation to be how it is. I don't want this for them. Okay, aversion is like this. This is what aversion feels like in the body. Just letting it be. So you're not going to war with your suffering. You're not fighting your suffering. You can do the same practice with the suffering that comes up within you in response to the suffering for another. Yes, I think the Buddha, there's a sutta called One Fortunate Desire. And it's about the great wholesomeness of the desire for liberation, because this is one of the wholesome desires. And actually, so I had mentioned that tanha first is the Pali word in the Four Noble Truths in the suttas. There's actually another word for desire, which is chanda. And chanda is more like an umbrella term for desire. And that can, within chanda, there can be unwholesome desires, but chanda also includes wholesome desires too. So that desire to be generous, to be kind, to be compassionate, to relieve suffering in the world. So these are all wholesome desires. The desire to practice, the desire to come to a sitting group on a Wednesday night. These are all really wholesome things. And these are onward leading. These are actually help guide one's life towards greater freedom. So one way of moving from the second noble truth to the third noble truth is letting go. That's half of the work. And the other half is cultivating. And often chanda leads to cultivation. We have a desire to cultivate wholesome quality. Let go of the unwholesome, cultivate the wholesome. So great to see all of you. Well, I hope you have a wonderful holiday season. Hope you stay safe and healthy. And I hope you have a wonderful new year filled with practice. I hope to see you all soon in person. Take care, everyone.